Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be in a room where it's not sort of strange that you spent 13 years at one school. it's pretty rare for that to be the case. But yeah, it was in 1989 that I started at what was a fledgling... Sorry, this is the topic I'll speak about as I go, but what was a fairly fledgling CPCS school at the time, Wycliffe, John Wycliffe Christian School. This is my year one photo. I couldn't find kindergarten. But as I said, after 13 years, I finished year 12 at that school with 22 of the 31 other students I'd started kindergarten with, and about 40 others who joined us at the school as it grew over those years, including Mr. Rusin's son. Our kindergarten teacher was the wife of a local minister. My memory is that she was a really tall lady who wore long skirts and ran her classroom tightly. She was frightening, and she was beautiful, and she loved to sing. My strongest memory of kindergarten is actually learning the books of the Bible to song. It was fairly age-appropriate faith formation, I think. We weren't asking questions of good and evil and the justice of God at that point. But at 4 years old, we were learning where we would find Isaiah and Habakkuk and Micah for when the time came we would need them. Another strong memory of my school is from high school. My school days is from high school, and it was my first economics lesson with Mr. Arundel. I've reminded him of this before, but he read to us from the parable of the talents and asked us what it told us about investment. It then turned into a lesson on hermeneutics, because we all found ourselves lifting the text straight out of context and asking us to tell us about modern investment practices. It was a lesson on why not to proof text. We were called the toilet school by other children in those days because of our atrocious uniforms of brown and yellow. It was also the good old days where OH&S wasn't thought a whole lot about, and so we spent our lunchtimes and recess in the bush in an area that had been roped off called Cubby Land, where we got to make whatever we wanted out of the branches and sticks and rocks that we found. I really enjoyed the humanities when I was going through school. And in year 11, the curriculum changed and literary theory became a stronger part of our English course. And we were being asked to ask questions about where meaning lies in a text. I remember sitting in our classroom in year 12, two of our classes combined, all of us packed into a room that was made for half the number, both our teachers in there. We were sitting on seats, we were sitting on tables, and we were having this debate about where meaning lies. Is it with the author? Is it with the text? Is it with the reader? I don't think I've ever been so captured by a class. And our teachers wouldn't let us rest on easy answers. They kept pushing us to think more. What does that mean for the Bible? I remember one of our teachers asking us. What gives something authority? What does it mean that the Word became flesh? What does it mean that truth is found in a person? It's a brilliant class that I still remember vividly. And they drew up a diagram that I still think about at times today. They said, what if meaning has something to do with a relationship between an author, a reader, and a text? This really interesting Trinitarian view, and it was a completely inspiring class. Towards the end of my time at Wycliffe, we had this new block that was built, and we'd have whole school assemblies on these concrete stairs that went down to kind of an atrium area. And there were balconies that sat above, and the younger students would sit on the balcony and we'd sit on the concrete stairs in high school. And there were banners that would hang from the balcony. And those banners said, nurturing faith, unwrapping truth, enabling thoughtful action. I remember reading those banners and understanding, probably for the first time, why my parents had sent me to a Christian school. The vision was more than one of providing me with a safe and nurturing environment. It was something about introducing me to a way of being in the world, a way of life that was instructive and shaping. I loved those phrases. They've stuck with me, particularly unwrapping truth. The idea that truth is a gift, it's a present. It's something for you to enjoy uncovering and revealing. Unlike a lot of students, I actually hated leaving Year 12. I was ready to leave the pattern of school days, but I wasn't ready to leave a community that had so fundamentally shaped me and given me a place of belonging. But I think, like all good nests, it ultimately did prepare me to move long distances to very different places with very different people. About half of my adult life has been spent overseas, mostly in New Zealand and then in London, as Mark mentioned, working for public policy think tanks for a lot of that time. It was really by accident that I fell into that work. It was, like anyone intelligent who listens to Rod speak, I followed him to learn more from Rod, was the initial motivation. But it's proved to be a privilege and a joy for me, that work, as I've learned more about how government works, how we negotiate our life together, and how we can contribute to good lawmaking and play a part in the process. 4 years ago, I moved back to Australia, and for the past 3 years, I've been in Sydney working for Baptist World Aid, which is an overseas development agency. It's working with Christians around the world who are trying to tackle poverty in local communities. But in just a few weeks' time, I will be making a move to Canberra and working with Eric to carry forward Martin and before him Bob's and others' work with AACS. It feels a really strange, to be honest, and also lovely return to be back in a room like this. Years ago, I was on an internship, the internship that I went to New Zealand originally for. We had a week of being tutored by a man called Jim Houston, who was the founder of Regent College, a Bible college in Canada. We were all in our early or mid-20s, and we were trying to work out what to do with our lives. We were imagining what felt like limitless possibilities that our lives could go down. And Jim Houston, who was in his 80s, I think, already, he listened to us muse about where we might have the most impact, what would suit us best, all the options we felt we had. And he said to us at the end of that, he said, just don't squander your inheritance. He meant we shouldn't ignore where we were from and the communities we've belonged to. For one of my peers, that was a particularly significant thing. It made him think about not walking too quickly away from a family business that he was suited to and prepared for, but he didn't want to do because it was predictable. I didn't really know what it meant for me. I was a long way from home. I was in a place that wasn't like where I'd grown up, but that was a wonderful and formative place. But his comment did stick with me, and I recently recalled it when I was thinking about this new role. The inheritance that I think has been passed on to me is something about a desire to see people nurtured and formed with a faith that can connect with the world as it is. There's something really fitting about being back in a context that so richly formed me, hopefully doing something small to contribute back for the sake of the next generation that will follow. I've loved working in secular environments when I've done that. And while Christian education's had a strong call on the life of some members of my family and even of my sort of in-law family, my field of play so far has been different. But I'm drawn to this work because I love what Christian schooling can offer and because I have a hunch that this is a really important time, not just for Christian schools, but also for the shape of our life as a country. What diversity of religion and thought and expression we permit is significant for who we'll be in another 20 or 40 or 60 years. As we all probably know, one of the pressing questions that we'll be carrying forward with is really one about freedom. Freedom is something we really do need to care a lot about. It's foundational to how we organise our life together. It's at the heart of our constitution, about powers being shared, about people having rights and freedoms, about protection from tyrants, from tyranny. It's easy in a country like Australia to think that that's never actually a threat, but it doesn't take long to realise that that's not the case when you study history or you visit other places. I passed the war memorial yesterday and I noticed that there's signs at each driveway that say, "For we are young and free." In the past few years, my work has given me a glimpse of what life looks like when freedom is absent. Earlier just this year, I visited Bangladesh with my current work with Baptist World Aid, and we met women who've been working in garment factories for years, not earning enough to cover their basic living costs, which means that they've fallen more and more deeply into debt and find themselves making impossible choices. But it's not just in Bangladesh. When I worked in London, I had the privilege of looking after a network of 350 charities that were grassroots social change initiatives. My role was just to coordinate with them to get them informing some of the policy work. They were working all over Britain to look at the root causes of poverty and try and turn things around in their communities. In the name of freedom, in the name of liberty, the legalisation of prostitution was being argued for by many. I spent a few nights that year on a van that travelled the streets of Bristol, offering a haven to women who were working the streets. These weren't high-end escorts. These were women who were nearly all homeless, who were addicted to drugs, and who had no other options for survival. The women who ran the van were mostly from churches, and the women who came on the van would call them angels. And I had the chance to hear a number of their stories on those days and nights. None of them were where they wanted to be. Most of them were making money for pimps they were scared of. 90% as children had been removed from their parents and had been wards of the state. At night they would get up, they would dress up, they would get high, and they would play the part they needed to. And then during the day, they'd come to a drop-in centre that was also being run, where they would sleep and cry and see a doctor. There's one woman who I won't forget ever, who spent most of one of those nights on the van with us. So normally what would happen is the women would come on for 10 minutes, have a sandwich, fix their makeup, have a chat and go back out. But this woman was 19 years old. She'd been released from a six-month stint in prison just a couple of weeks earlier, and she desperately didn't want to work the streets. But she was also homeless. Her granny had died while she was in prison, and her uncle had taken over her granny's house where she'd previously lived. He was a drug dealer, and she didn't want to go near him. She had nowhere to go. Her only friends were the women who were working that night. And one of them was letting her at night climb in through the window of the boarding house that she lived in to sleep on the floor of her room. That friend was working, so she was on the van waiting for the friend to finish. But after hours, that friend didn't come back. So she sat and quietly just cried on the van. When it got to midnight, the van normally finished and the friend hadn't returned. The emergency shelters of the city were full. We had nowhere to take her. Eventually, after a number of phone calls, we got hold of a church that had started opening its doors to rough sleepers, and they agreed to take her. She said to me, "I just want to be curled up in bed with a book." We dropped her off, and a woman from the church came out, gave her a hug and said, "I've got a bed made up for you." And I have no idea what happened to her after that night. Why do I tell that story? It's because I want to reflect just a little bit on how confused we can be about freedom, and how it's about more than us having a bunch of rights preserved in the law. Freedom isn't just about our legal protections, it's about the kind of people we are. It's about the kind of society we live in and the vision for life that we have. The truth is that a country that produced the Magna Carta can have citizens who are about as trapped as a person can be. When we think about freedom for our schools, when we think about freedom of religion, most of the time we're talking about the legal environment we operate with, and that's the work Eric and I will be picking up from Martin, among other things. What freedoms will we retain? What sort of environment will we operate in? What freedoms will schools continue to enjoy about choosing who they employ, what they teach, how they teach? What permission will we have to opt out of things that run contrary to our convictions? And ultimately, how viable will our schools even be? These questions are really real and they're really important, and they're the ones that are motivating me to work for AACS. But freedom isn't just about this. It's not just about the conditions that the powers out there want to impose or protect. Alongside the work that needs to be done regarding ensuring we have solid ground on which to work, we need to be asking what our freedom's for. The job isn't done if we've retained our freedom and or extended a bunch of rights and we're not worthy of that permission. If you took a straw poll about what freedom means, I think the general kind of idea is about the ability to choose. That's a reasonable enough kind of description of it. People are free when they have capacity to make choices, when they can make decisions about their life and their identity. And as long as we all give each other those freedoms, then all will be well, is the general idea. People should be free to make choices about their lives. Sometimes, though, that view makes me feel a little bit sheepish about being a Christian. I don't know if it does for anyone else. I get a bit confused and think, oh, but sometimes we seem to be a bit oppressive in this. If freedom's tied to our ability to exercise our will, Christianity sometimes seems to challenge that. I read an article in the journal First Things that was written by Dan Hitchens, who writes about how the UK press responded when a Catholic MP said he objects to abortion in every circumstance. One UK columnist said, she basically described how it's kind of a nice crutch if you get to have religion because you don't have to make any decisions about yourself. Religions tell us, get up, wash, eat, pray, wear and do this and that before or after doing whatever else. Don't eat, don't drive, carry money, work, speak on this day or that. The UK comedian David Mitchell also said in his column that while there's some attraction in religion, it seems to him that to adopt religion would be to squander his freedom to work out his own beliefs. In this article, Dan Hitchens responds to those views by pointing out that that idea of freedom is actually very different to what Christians mean by the word. He says, for Christians, freedom consists not, not in how many choices you have, but in whether you can choose the right thing, the good thing. For Christians, freedom consists not in how many choices you have, but whether you can choose the right thing, the good thing. His point is really important. In Scripture, yes, freedom is about setting people free, about enslaved people finding freedom, and about a God who doesn't force himself on people, but who always invites. The nature of God's activity towards us tells us that freedom is something incredibly important, that we should be cautious if we ever remove it. But the picture of freedom in Scripture isn't just that. It's not limitless choice. It's not autonomy or self-reliance or self-actualization. In Scripture, a person's free when they have chosen what is good and true and beautiful. I'm not an Old Testament scholar, but I understand that one of the words used for freedom in the Old Testament to speak of the Passover is also used to speak about the etching of the Ten Commandments into stone. The likening of freedom of Israel through Passover with the handing of the law. To be free is to engrave the law of God into our lives. We aren't free when we're trying to make a life for ourselves. In fact, that's what Dante pictured as hell, a place where everyone is his or her own God. In contrast, we're free when we're tethered to the one in whom all meaning is found. That's the view of freedom we get from Paul. In 2 Corinthians, Paul says, the people of God who've been baptized into Christ are like letters that are sent out, delivered to the world. But the word of God isn't written in ink on them. It's the Spirit written on their hearts. Christ has set us free to have the law of God engraved on our hearts. To be free is to be liberated from the bondage of sin, liberated from the bondage of death, restored to the humanity for which you were made. To no longer be crippled by being turned in on ourselves, but to be free to have a life directed towards what it was made for. To quote Dan Hitchens again, he said, "The model of a free human being, then, is not the person who has so much money, time, and imagination that he can do whatever comes to his head, but someone who will choose the good, who knows just how to make a friend happy, or who offered the chance to become wealthy through committing fraud, can turn it down without a second thought. Freedom's about exercising our will to act on our longings for what is good, for happiness, for flourishing. And so it's also something that grows in us. It grows in us through wise habits, through our education, through emulating others who live well. Our capacity to think and choose and discern is vital. It distinguishes us from animals. It lets us direct ourselves towards good ends. And we have to learn this. We learn it in our families. We learn it in our churches, hopefully. And what an opportunity some young people have to learn it at their Christian school. George Weigel describes freedom a bit like playing the piano. He uses this as an analogy. He says, I feel like pianos are used as analogies all the time, but it's a good one. You can bang at a piano and make noise, but mastering the exercises allows you to uncover a richer dimension of freedom. So you've got the freedom just to bang away. But once you know how, you can play what you like and you can even make music of your own. Freedom is like that. It's about gradually acquiring the capacity to choose the good, to select our preferences out of an orientation that has been formed towards goodness. Law and regulation give us the parameters that let us do that. And sometimes they prevent us from walking into serious error. Ideally, they point us towards what is good sometimes. They have to give us room. They have to give us a wide enough playing field to not act just out of coercion. But as I said before, retaining our playing field is just one part of the picture of how our schools need to exercise their freedom. Too often, even as Christians, we've run after a vision of freedom that's left people enslaved. We've confused discipleship too often with self-actualization, some of what was being spoken about yesterday. Jim Houston, the founder of Regent College, who I mentioned earlier, says, "We have credit cards and we can wander the whole world, but so much of our freedom is a kind of bondage. It's bondage to ourselves, and that's the real problem we face. Our drug culture tells us how free we really are. It's when you have open hands to life, not desiring anything adulterously or addictively, that you have freedom." He says that the church has started to look secular some of the time. He says many Christian leaders that he meets are burned out by their own expectations and their successes and their need for self-fulfillment. And that's not freedom. He says the closer you get to Christ, the more you tend to suffer. You get clobbered, he says. But that's Christian freedom. The greatest curse we can ask for, this is Jim's words, the greatest curse we can ask for is to do whatever we like. And the greatest blessing is that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. When asked what he thinks about the future of our Christian institutions, he said, who knows? It's not looking good. He says being a Christian's lost a lot of credibility. But the credibility of the gospel, he reminds us, is that Christ has set us free. And that's the inheritance we pass on to the next generation. As Steve was speaking yesterday, I found myself wondering how many of us have traded the desire to make ourselves transcendent with wanting to do the same for our children. They become the project and the goal of our fulfillment. It's no better. I'm not a parent, so it's really easy to say. But there are a lot of children in my life that I love, including my three nephews, and I am very, very regularly tempted to just wish a really easy life for them, one that won't involve... In fact, I don't even cope with their tears on tiny things, so one that won't involve any tears or pain for them. I'm not sure that's what I should want. We mustn't pass on to our children a vision of autonomy and a vision of freedom in which they can be whatever they like and make their lives their own. The best inheritance we can give them, part of me doesn't want to say it, but the best inheritance we can give them is the yoke of the gospel. The chance to be people whose hearts are bent towards the goodness for which they were made, who have the capacity to choose what's good, regardless of what that might require of them. They're just like us. They're going to just have to face new questions in a new generation. Legal protections mean nothing if we effectively enslave our children in our schools by offering them nothing more than what they're offered by a culture that ignores Christ and we just throw some Christian symbols in. If we belittle or cheapen faith, if we make it just another pathway to a life that's healthy and wealthy and that will stoke their egos, if it just becomes nothing other than self-actualization by another name. And equally, legal protections mean nothing if we effectively enslave our children in our schools by forcing them or threatening them into a way of life that they don't freely commit to. That's the sort of criticism we often hear about the era when Christianity was dominant. We can invite and we can point a way and we can instruct and we can paint a vision for life that's deeply compelling. But each student must also be given the freedom to make decisions about what sort of pathway they'll take. There was a film called Silence that came out, I think it was a bit over a year ago, by Martin Scorsese. I don't know whether many people saw it. It had really small release. Absolutely loved this film. It's based on a novel by a Japanese author called Shisaku Endo, and it tells the story, it's based loosely on history, it tells the story of 17th century Jesuit priests who travel from Portugal to Japan to try and find out what happened to their mentor who, rumour has it, recanted his faith in the face of persecution. Probably the climax of the film, it really ends up being centred around one particular priest and his wrestle with whether or not to deny his faith by stamping on an icon of Christ in order to relieve the suffering of a group of peasant Christians who are being persecuted and who have been following him, who've been looking to him as a leader. An image of Jesus is put in front of them. There's a scene actually separate to this, but where, so this is the priest who they kind of, who it ends up centering around, but they put an image icon in front of the peasants and say, just touch it with your foot, lightly if you like, however you like, and you'll be free immediately. And then in another really gripping scene, the priest who has recanted tries to persuade this priest to do the same. He says, you see Jesus in Gethsemane and you believe your trial is the same. The peasants don't have your pride. They would never compare themselves to Jesus. Do you have the right to make them suffer? What would you do for them? Pray? And get what in return? Only more suffering. Suffering you can end. I watched this film and I was like desperately egging him on to recant his faith. Who cares about the stupid image? I kept thinking. But I read a review later that talks about how effectively that was a Gnostic kind of idea, that you can separate out your private faith from your public stance. And what is really striking in the film is that when faith is abandoned or cheapened, something that can just exclusively be something, become something I do in my own little corner and never really even confess out loud, there is no hope left for the peasants of Japan. They're not suddenly free from tyrannical rulers. Their lives aren't suddenly easy. They might not be being tortured, but they are not free. For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. I'm grateful to say that my experience of Christian education was one that was freeing. It commissioned me for a life that isn't my own. My friends from school have all gone in all sorts of different directions and all have their own journeys and will continue to live those out. Some have left the Christian faith. Some have endured despite incredible challenges. Some have watched from the edges and aren't quite sure where to stand anymore. Certainly, though, I suspect for most, they remain haunted by a question: to whom do I belong? Whose am I? I think the years ahead will probably be challenging for our schools. The credibility challenge for Christians is not an easy one for us to tackle. I don't know what lines we'll be able to hold. And our fears may also amount to nothing. There may not be the challenges, or those that come may just fizzle. God knows. But we can be certain that we don't see the whole picture. I love this picture, this painting, it's a painting of the Nativity. It's called The Nativity, and it's by an American painter called Brian Koshiznik, I think it is. I just love Joseph's face, hidden among the overwhelming brightness of a crowd of angels that he doesn't see. There's just so much that we don't know. Out of all sorts of unexpected places, the Spirit of God moves. In unlikely corners, in homeless shelters, in places that aren't the West, the gospel is alive and well. In the years ahead, we will need to be realistic about the challenges before us. But I think we can also remember that, like Joseph in this painting, there's a lot we don't know, a lot we don't see. There'll be no Donald Trump. There'll be no European Union, probably no nation called Australia in 1,000 years. But there will be Christ, and there will be a communion of saints and an enduring church. So as you carry out your challenging tasks, you'll be in my prayers. And please do pray for Eric and I and Mark Spencer and others doing similar work in other places. May we all be faithful and hope-filled. Mm-hmm.
Yes.